Suffering is the great problem of humanity. How do we explain evil? Both the evil in man and the horrific things of which humanity is both capable and guilty, and the evil in nature that destroys life inexplicably. This question, particularly, strangely enough, the second part of it, is arguably the greatest stumbling block when it comes to belief in God. If God is good, so the thinking goes, why is there so much misery in the world? You know, how could a good God allow suffering? Or, of course, as Rabbi Kushner famously phrased it, why do bad things happen to good people, right? And of course, Rabbi Kushner's answer to that question was not that God is not good. His answer was that God is not in control. He's simply not able to do anything about the evil in the world. But indeed, suffering is the greatest stumbling block for humanity when it comes to belief in God. You know, I like to listen to lectures of the atheist intellectuals like Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins and those guys. And almost without fail, the problem of evil comes up, the problem of suffering comes up as the stumbling block that none of them can get over. It's not that the evidence isn't there at the end of the day. It's that they will not believe in a God who lets the world be like it is. And it isn't as if suffering is only a problem for atheists. You know, it's also a problem for religious people. And it, in fact, is a producer of formerly religious people. Former Christians like liberal Bible scholar Bart Ehrman will often point to the problem of evil as one of the catalysts of their deconversion. But many of us in this room have also experienced the same pressure that trials put on you to drive you away from God. You know, in many of our own personal lives, you and I have felt the weight of suffering put serious strain on our confidence in God. In fact, in his commentary on Job, Walter Kaiser wrote, that all too often, suffering shakes the trust and faith of men and women. Suffering can and does drive people away from belief in God, let alone creating circumstances for the perfect storms of life-destroying sins and moments of failure. Suffering provides ripe opportunity for what we call apostasy, or the falling away of from the Christian faith. People simply cannot go on believing in God when they're under the crushing weight of the miseries of life. And this is exactly why when Jesus gave us the Lord's Prayer, which is God's top six priorities that should shape our prayer life, in a sense, a kind of equivalent to the Ten Commandments, which are the summary of the law of God, Jesus told us that we need to be praying that God would not lead us into testings or temptations, but that he would deliver us from them. And in fact, if you remember, the Lord actually chastised Peter and the other disciples in the garden for not praying for that very thing. Matthew 26, 40 through 41 says that Jesus came to his disciples and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, "So could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." Suffering and evil, especially when they happen to us and not out there, not only afford opportunities for gross and remarkable sins and failure, but they challenge our very faith itself. They test our confidence in the goodness of God and even in his very existence. Maybe you can attest to this. I know that I certainly can. Almost 10 years ago, right after I graduated from Bible college, life threw Becky and I a succession of curveballs, not internal things or sin issues on our part or in our marriage or anything like that, but outside things that we didn't have any control over. But they really turned our lives upside down and changed us, I feel, forever, at least speaking for myself. You know, during most of that first year, I was not able to find full-time work, and I had a number of part-time things going on at the same time. And we were in Southern California, and I had a wife and a new daughter, and I just wasn't making enough money, and that was pretty tough. I had never burned any bridges and had always been a good worker, but I'd done a little of this and a little of that, and I didn't have any meaningful experience in anything. But I didn't realize that until I had a young family and had to find a livable wage. I had a Bible degree and then a design degree and a few years experience in this and a few years experience in that. I had done a few different things while I was in college and paying my bills. But on paper, I simply was not hireable, and I was actually told that a few times during that first year. Of course, that went on for the better part of a year, and I finally found full-time work as an in-house graphic designer. And the pay wasn't great, and there weren't any benefits, but it was full-time work. And then 8 months later, I was laid off. And then within about a month of that, two things happened. Becky found out that she was pregnant with our second baby, Daisy. The house that we were renting sold, and the new buyers wanted in right away. And so we had to get out right away, all right after I had lost my job, after this stretch of being underemployed as it was. Well, fortunately, Becky's sister and her husband, who lived up the coast near San Luis Obispo, they said we could come and stay with them. They had a toddler son of their own and only about 700 square feet, but we had nowhere else to go. And I had just been laid off, and they were family, and we all got along great, and we went. And so far as it goes, it was great, and it worked out fine. Now, I was already pretty thoroughly demoralized by the few years previous to that. But the combination of the layoff and then having to move and not being able to get a house and expecting a new baby all at the same time was tremendously difficult. But it wasn't until we actually moved up the coast, at least for me, that things got really dark and difficult. After the layoff, I began applying for anything, anywhere that I might remotely qualify for. Teaching jobs, warehouse jobs, driving jobs, jobs in Florida, Boise, Idaho, Charlotte, North Carolina, you name it. I was applying for it. And I started getting interviews right away. But they were all for design jobs only, and they were all on the coast between Ventura County and San Luis Obispo. Well, over the course of the next 10 months, I had about 25 job interviews. I stopped counting at about 18, and I did not have a single offer in all of those jobs. For many of those jobs, I was the number two candidate, and for one of them, I was only one of two people who applied. Well, during that 10-month stretch, I was bagging groceries at the Ralph's there in town and delivering pizzas at night in Morro Bay. And thankfully, I met a guy there in town who was an entrepreneur, and he was able to send some freelance work my way. But that's what I did for 10 months while I slept on my brother-in-law's couch, you know, with a wife and two babies and not able to afford a place of our own. And it was excruciating. You know, on the California Central Coast, at that time, the average rent was somewhere in the neighborhood of $3,000 a month. I made something like $9,000 over that stretch, like something appalling. You know, I had a lot of losses and a lot of disappointments and a lot of failures and a lot of frustration and bitterness and anger and borderline disillusionment for quite a stretch. Lloyd remembers all of that. You know, there were a lot of times early in the mornings when it was still dark and I was the only one awake trying to read my Bible and pray on my brother-in-law's couch, that I felt so lost and so alone and crushed by those circumstances, and there was absolutely no human solution to any of it. I just felt entirely at the mercy of God, and there was absolutely nothing I could do about my situation. There was nothing I could do for my resume to dress it up, to make myself more appealing. There was absolutely nothing I could do. And to be, you know, really, really candid about it, there were times in my mind that I weighed my life insurance policy versus the money that I was actually able to earn at that time. You know, I don't know if I would have ever actually gone that far, But those are the kinds of things that cross your mind, you know, in the crushing weight of life. It was a hard and dark time, to say the least. Well, I finally got a decent paying design job with an agency right there in San Luis Obispo. And very gradually, things began to improve. You know, we got our own place a couple months later. It was just a really quiet little place that we really, you know, we really had a lot of good times in there. It was a great price. 2 years later, I had a good opportunity that allowed me to go into business for myself, which I did and have been doing now for 4 years. And, you know, more earning potential with that. Obviously, we had a couple more kids. And while there was a steady upward climb out of the pit after I got that agency job, and while our lives on the Central Coast were very pleasant and happy and peaceful, for which I'm very thankful and which I very much enjoyed, I would say that the difficulty never really stopped. And maybe you can relate to that. You know, in a lot of ways, it feels like that time is still clinging to us. You know, overall, what was the hardest, darkest period of my life lasted about a solid 5 years. And it very literally tested my faith in God. But that's exactly how the Bible describes it, doesn't it? It's the testing of your faith that the Bible talks about, which produces perseverance. Well, that period really changed me, and probably forever. And in some ways, I feel like it's casted a cloud over my life that I don't know if it will ever fully burn off. And maybe you can relate to that. But all of this is simply to say this. The evil of suffering and evil are problems for every human being, including the people of God. Enter the book of Job. And if you'll give me 1 second, I need a Kleenex. Well, I've always had an attraction to the book of Job as long as I've been a believer. But it wasn't until the difficulties of the last 10 years that I really dug into it. And it was really in the middle of that dark time at my brother-in-law's house that I would say that I really became familiar with Job and with, I trust, what is God's message for us through it. And the reason is clear, I think. I was suffering, obviously not nearly to the degree of Job, but I was suffering, and Job is the primary example of suffering in human history. But more than that, Job is the account of the role of God in Job's suffering. And by nature of the case, it is the account of God's role in my suffering. And so it was natural and appropriate for me to see Job that way, because that's exactly how God intends for us to see it. In other words, God's purpose in the sufferings of Job is that you see the purposes of God in your suffering and that I see the purposes of God in mine. You know, G. Campbell Morgan says this very thing in his little book, The Answer of Job to Jesus, or the Answer of Jesus to Job. He says, "The book of Job faces a fact which is everywhere apparent in human life and which still causes perplexity. There is suffering, sometimes tragic and terrible suffering in the world, which is not the result of the sin of the sufferer. And I see at this moment in a cottage in the country a girl lying on a bed where she has lain for 28 years, suffering through no sin of her own. And thank God many mercies attend her circumstances. But there she lies, suffering through 28 years. And that is the background of this book." End quote. It is the divine intent that you and I see our suffering in the suffering of Job. Not in a mirror as if our suffering is identical to his in details and degree, but in similarity of kind. And most importantly, in the lessons that God wants us to learn about him and ourselves in the difficulties and tragedies of life. So I wanted to understand Job and his suffering and God's purpose in it, because I was so desperate for some kind of divine truth upon which to set my feet during that time of darkness and instability in those years. Okay, about Job itself, the book. Job is obviously the historical account of a wealthy believing man from a place called Uz. And all of this we learn in the first three verses of chapter 1. So let's go ahead and open up there to Job chapter 1 and read the first three verses. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys, and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the people in the East. Job, a wealthy, believing man from a place called Uz, right? The location of Uz was probably in or near northwestern Saudi Arabia, kind of southeast of Israel. And Job's name might come from a Hebrew root meaning enemy, or possibly an Arabic root meaning to repent. There's not really any certainty about that. Either of those two items, Job's name or the location of Uz. But these and a handful of other uncertainties notwithstanding, Job is in fact historical. It is the actual account of an actual man from an actual place called Uz. And the record of his life is precisely that. It's a record. You know, this is taken for granted by Ezekiel in Ezekiel chapter 14, and also by James in James 5, verses 10 and 11, when James writes, "As an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful." So Job is a historical account. And just as James says, it is the account of the suffering of Job. Essentially, all at once, Job loses his children, his wealth, his health, his reputation, both in the eyes of his friends and in the eyes of the community. And he also lost, as G. Campbell Morgan again says, he also lost the partnership of love and faith. That is the fabric of the relationship between he and his wife. So Job literally is stripped of essentially everything in life that gives us joy and meaning in the matter of probably just a couple of days. And you and I can probably only imagine that. I mean, most of us know what it feels like to lose something essential to life. Maybe 2 things essential to life over the course of a year. But to lose all of those things, every part of his manhood, in the span of a couple of days? Well, interestingly enough, although historical, the account of Job is not given to us in standard historical narrative. In other words, the writer of Job doesn't just tell us about the things that happened. Rather, Job is given to us primarily in the form of Hebrew poetry. And if you don't know, out of 42 chapters, all but chapters 1 and 2 and the last 11 verses of the last chapter are all written in Hebrew poetry. That's a full 85% of the book. Now, if you don't know, unlike English poetry, Hebrew poetry is not built on rhyme or cadence. Rather, it's built on parallels. In other words, Hebrew poetry, it creates emphasis and contrast by restating or by comparing things. That's why, for example, you see Job agonizing for 8 solid verses in chapter 3, from verse 11 all the way down to 19, about how he wishes that he were stillborn. And he's only saying one thing in that section. He's saying, "I wish I had died at birth." And if you read those verses, chapter 3, verse 11 through 19, you'll see that. He's only saying one thing, but he emphasizes it to the nth degree by saying it a number of different ways and by comparing it and contrasting it and elaborating on it over and over again. And that's precisely how Hebrew poetry works. What's also interesting about Job is that, while historical, it's not grouped along with the historical books of the Old Testament. Rather, it's grouped with the wisdom literature. And as most of you know, the Old Testament wisdom books, besides Job, include Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon, right? And all of those are also written primarily in Hebrew poetry. But Job is not included among the wisdom literature because of its poetry. No, Job is grouped with the wisdom literature for a very different reason. And I have a somewhat lengthy quote by a pastor named Mark Minnick, who's been very influential on my life, that I think helps explain the reason for Job's being grouped with those books. Dr. Minnick says this: "The historical books of the Old Testament and the five books of Moses are just telling you what happened. But in the poetry books, you've got people reflecting on what's happening. You've got the inner response of those people and what's going on in their hearts to those circumstances. And what the poetry books make apparent is that life, even for God's people, is filled with defeat, disappointment, and despair. And they set before you your soul, your inner man. And you've got God revealing that all of us are internally weak and failing and easily toppled. And it shows you this need. If things are going to be right in a world like this, where you can't control things externally, what needs changing is not our circumstances, but what we are internally." And that is exactly what Job is about, isn't it? You know, here's a man just like you and I who has no control over the horrific set of circumstances in which he finds himself, and he's suffering miserably. And the pinnacle of the book, if you remember, and by the way, I'm kind of assuming that we're all basically familiar with the book of Job, the pinnacle of it is actually a 4-chapter rebuke of Job by God himself that demonstrates precisely Dr. Minnick's point. There's something internally that's not right with Job. His circumstances are not his problem. If things are going to be right in a world like ours, a world in which suffering and evil are necessary features of life for every single person, and you can't control that, you and I don't need new circumstances. We need new hearts and minds. So, who wrote Job, and when was it written? Well, who, we don't know. And when is also not certain, though it was probably considerably later than the actual events themselves. The ESV Study Bible, which I have right here, suggests that Job was written during or shortly after the exile, possibly around the time of Ezekiel or Nehemiah. But because of a number of factors, which you can read about, by the way, in the intro material to Job in the MacArthur Study Bible, it's fairly reasonable that Job lived during or even before the time of Abraham. So written during occurred during Abraham, written during Ezekiel. In other words, that would put the words recorded in Job among the very first words that God ever spoke to humanity. This is some of the earliest revelation of God to men. And that is profoundly significant when you consider the issue at stake in the book. And this is where I want to end before I jump into the few questions that I have. What is the point of the book? Job experiences the horrible tragedies and is overwhelmed by the darkness of misery. And the whole issue, which is reflected in a debate between Job and his friends, that 85% in the middle of those 42 chapters, the key issue is, why has all of this happened? Why, and why Job? That's the great unanswerable vanity of vanities, right? Why is Job suffering? That's the issue at stake. And Job's friends have their own answer. Job doesn't know, and God never says. The greatest problem in human existence that we talked about at the beginning, right? That great stumbling block produces so many ex-Christians, is the exasperator of so many atheists, provides ripe opportunity for sin and failure and doubt among God's people. That great problem of suffering and evil remains unanswered by the only one who could answer it. Job's suffering, in the truest sense of the term, is unexplained. However, as we read through the book, we can, and we do, and I trust that we will in the coming weeks, we can and do and will see God's purpose in Job's suffering. And by extension, we'll see God's purpose in our own suffering. And that is precisely why God gave us this account of Job. And again, these things are among the very first truths that God ever revealed to the human race. In other words, just to put it in really crystal clear terms, and I would just really ask that you really catch this. Some of the very first things that God ever has to say to man are about the purposes of God in human suffering. And man has had a problem all this time with that. As long as man has existed, he's had a problem with it. But some of the very first things that God had to say to man were to resolve that issue for him. I don't know that we've ever listened, but it really does point us, all of this really does point us right back to Dr. Minnick's insight from earlier. We don't need new circumstances. We need new hearts and minds, and God alone can give us those things. You know, requests for prayer usually involve requests for comfort and healing and success and safety and a quick recovery and all those kinds of things. All the things that characterized Job's life before his trials, right? All of the very things that God was so willing be so suddenly ripped away from him. Those are very often the things that we ask for in prayer. But God knows that we, just like Job, don't need favorable circumstances or outcomes in these circumstances. Absolutely, we want safety and comfort and health for ourselves and for each other. And like James says, God is so merciful and compassionate to give us those things so much of the time. But the heavy lifting of God's work in our lives is not done in the calm seas. It's done in the storms and in the refining fires of the crucible of suffering. And again, this is among the very first truths that God ever revealed to humanity. But thankfully, it's also not the last truth that he revealed to us, right? Because what do we know now about trials on this side of the cross that Job could only hope were true, that Job could only suspect in faith? G. Campbell Morgan again says it best. Great cries come out to Job. They come out of Job, so stripped and lonely. Cries of need, cries of inquiry, cries of challenge. Then I shut the book and find no answer to any of those questions. It is a great thing to have had that unveiling of human need. But there is no answer. But then I turn to the New Testament and I see Jesus, who began without any wealth, who went through life largely devoid of the things that others depend on. And before I am through with Jesus, I find that he has answered every question Job asked and supplied every need that Job revealed. Well, Lord willing, in the coming weeks, I'm confident that we'll see something of what our Savior has to say to Job and to us in these things.